Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Ed Ayers. Each week, along with my colleagues, Nathan Connolly, Brian Ballow, and Joanne Freeman, we explore a part of American history that's been in the news. For several weeks, nothing has dominated national and international headlines more than the coronavirus. As of this week, approximately 113,000 cases have been identified worldwide. More than 4,000 deaths have been reported, while concerns about the spread of coronavirus have led to widespread quarantines and cancellations of public gatherings. Coronavirus is threatening people across the world, and it's also affecting global markets. Some economists are predicting a recession, and there's talk of potential bailouts for hard-hit industries such as air travel and cruise ships. The coronavirus might be new, but this is by no means the first time that America and the world have found themselves in the grip of a deadly virus. Over a century ago, in 1918, Spanish influenza caused a global pandemic, spread in large part by soldiers returning home from the First World War. The virus killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million people worldwide. But the story of the virus and the many lives it affected has often been forgotten. Back in 2018, Backstory looked at the history of Spanish influenza in an episode entitled Forgotten Flu, America and the 1918 Pandemic. So, in the wake of ongoing concerns about coronavirus, we wanted to revisit a couple of segments from that show to learn about how people from the past dealt with a terrifying and unpredictable virus. In this first segment, Brian talks to Nancy Bristow, a historian at the University of Puget Sound and the author of American Pandemic, The Lost Worlds of the 1918 Influenza Epidemic. Scholars estimate that some 675,000 Americans died from the Spanish flu and that a quarter of the population was infected. As Brian learned, this put a huge strain on the country's medical resources and medical personnel who were desperate to stop the spread of disease.
On the local level, the actual fighting that takes place is at the local public health boards, so that you have in cities and towns across the country these public health experts who are trying to impose restrictions on the behaviors of their people.
So what were some of the specific measures that local health boards took?
Well, they started with the easiest ones, and these always make my audiences smile. They outlawed spitting in public, and they took away what was called the shared or public drinking cup. So today we imagine a water fountain with a stream of water. In the old days, you just grabbed the same cup right. The person behind you and the person in front of you would use. So those are the easy things. That's the low-hanging fruit.
And did they actually organize shopping on different days for different people?
In some communities, they would have staggered work hours. They would have staggered shopping hours. And what that means literally is just that if you had things open at different times, it would keep the public transportation less crowded, for instance. So the purpose is just to establish sort of a calendar across the day so that people would be in smaller numbers so that you could stretch the public out across the hours of the day rather than having everybody doing the same things at the same moment. But gradually they would impose much more interventionist measures. So they might at first just ban public meetings, and then they might move on to closing down bars and closing down public amusements. And then they might decide that even the schools and churches needed to be closed. And then they might impose a public masking where everyone in public had to wear a gauze mask, and might also engage with quarantining. Those would be the most interventionist and the most highly resisted actions that they would take.
Did people come to any conclusions about the effectiveness of those efforts, something like quarantine? There were places that did use it. Did they fare better in the long run?
They did fare better in the long run. I'm not certain that at the time they could tell that. We know that today, mm-hmm. though, that quarantining and public distancing measures were really helpful. And the cities that had the earliest and longest restrictions on their publics had the best long-term results. They had the lowest death rates.
Now, what did people do to fight the flu? And was there anything that could be done to treat this?
There's nothing that can be done to treat it. In other words, you cannot address the illness itself. You can only treat the symptoms. And so they are taking good care, the nurses in particular, taking good care of the patients, not simply fluffing pillows, but keeping somebody warm, keeping them dry, keeping them clean, keeping them hydrated to the extent possible, giving them pain medication. Those were all useful things to do.
And I'm guessing that that health care was very gendered. I'm guessing that the docs were guys and that the disproportionate number of nurses were women.
That's exactly right. And it's certainly what people expected, even when there were exceptions to it. So as you read press accounts, they talk about the nurses as, you know, angels in white, and they talk about physicians and their strength and their expertise and their capacities to do these sort of manly things. But that's a setup for trouble.
Yeah. How did that work out when, by your description, the guys, the experts, are not being terribly successful in their approach?
For nurses, who were primarily women, the pandemic was a positive experience of sorts. In letters and diaries and yearbooks, they write about how horrific it was to observe these illnesses, but how fulfilled they felt, how empowered they were, even the kind of camaraderie and joy they found in doing good service together. And this is a real boon to nursing as a profession. For the physicians, you can read letters and diaries casting first that horrific vision of how awful it was to see this, and then the kind of defeat that this felt, the kind of meaning this carried for one's professional identity, and the kind of, not embarrassment, but kind of pain of loss in their capacity to believe in what was possible.
And this comes on the heels of quite a bit of medical and public health optimism. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And I think that's another piece of what makes this so frightening. People were unprepared. Just as we've said, they're used to influenza, but they also thought that they were in an era in which infectious disease was on its way out, that medicine and public health was advancing so rapidly that they would be able to eliminate things like the yearly flu.
And why did they believe that? What was happening?
The bacteriological revolution takes place in the late 19th century, where people in Europe, those famous doctors like Pasteur and Koch, are doing the work of discovering bacteria. Mm-hmm. They can finally, for the first time, identify the causal agent of illnesses.
Now, did people understand that the flu was not bacterial? Or did they figure that out?
So there is a theory about something that's even smaller than the bacteria they're able to see. There are people who are aware that that is existing, but they can't see it. They just can't see it yet. The technology is not available. So they can only operate on a theory. And this is one of the problems that I think the scientists and the physicians are facing during the pandemic.
Right.
And people write about, you know, I will never again talk about my profession being capable of doing everything and anything. Victor Vaughn, who was a very important, distinguished leader of American medicine, he was dean of the University of Michigan Medical School. He had already completed a term as the president of the American Medical Association. And he writes in his memoir in 1926 this about his experience during the pandemic. The saddest part of my life was when I witnessed the hundreds of deaths of soldiers in the army camps and did not know what to do. At that moment, I decided never again to prate about the great achievements of medical science and to humbly admit our dense ignorance in this case.
That's unbelievably horrible.
It is.
If we step back a little bit and look at the optimism about, you know, stamping out infectious diseases at the turn of the 20th century, there's a real parallel there. And the parallel is to the optimism, believe it or not, of stamping out great wars. People believe very strongly that better transportation, more trade was bringing the world together. Do you see any parallels between the optimism on the war front and the disease front, and then, in fact, what World War I and this pandemic led to?
I do. What's interesting for me is the way it plays in the aftermath, which is that in the aftermath of both the flu and the war, the nation is able to retain its optimism. And it retains it, I think, because of that war and what it does. So that in the public sphere, Americans feel bigger, stronger, and more important in the aftermath of the war, despite the disappointment and the disillusionment that the war brought. We see it in the 1920s with the explosion of the American economy and a great deal of belief that the way we're doing things is the way we should do things, and the withdrawal, in fact, from government activism, for instance. But in the aftermath of the pandemic, it's much harder to draw a kind of optimistic picture.
Does that mean that the war eclipses the pandemic quite quickly in people's memory?
That's exactly what happens. The pandemic, as you know, is referred to by many, and most famously by Alfred Crosby, the great historian, mm-hmm. as the forgotten pandemic. And there are a number of reasons that that happens, but certainly the war eclipses it, and in part because the war is a better story. The pandemic is the wrong story for where the nation sees itself in the aftermath of World War I. And I think it's much easier to subsume it under this glorious victory of the war, and as a result, to simply forget it in terms of its place in the public eye. There are no memorials. There are no anniversaries held for those who died or for those who, quote, fought the pandemic. It just disappears.
Nancy Bristow is a historian at the University of Puget Sound and the author of American Pandemic, The Lost Worlds of the 1918 Influenza Epidemic.
Like coronavirus, the impact of Spanish influenza was felt across the globe. The virus didn't respect national boundaries and traveled with soldiers headed home in boats and trains. Today's world, of course, is connected in ways undreamed of at the beginning of the 20th century. And as Brian explored with John Oxford, a virologist at the Royal London Hospital, these connections can have dire consequences when it comes to the spread of viruses and disease. Here's part of their conversation from the episode Forgotten Flu. It starts with Oxford talking about the international impact of the Spanish flu.
The deaths varied quite a lot in different countries. In some countries, for example, in Labrador, and nearly 100% of people in some of the villages died. And yet, in one place on this planet, actually organized by the United States, that is in Samoa, there was a complete quarantine. And as far as I know, no one died.
unbelievable. What was it about this particular flu that caused so many deaths? Was it the strain of the flu virus or something else?
It's probably a combination of things. I mean, groups in the States have resurrected the virus. They've tested it in little animal models, in mice, in cell culture. It does look slightly more virulent, maybe five times, but I don't think that really explains the deaths in 1918. And then you come on to the most recent possibility, which has always been in the background, that it somewhat depends on our immune history. What was the history of an old person? How many strains had they been infected with before 1918? Had they been infected with anything at all? So you've got that combination. You've got what the past immune history, the past infection history has been. On top of that, you've got a virus which is perhaps a little bit more virulent than a common or garden one. But on top of that, again, you've got one other factor that, of course, 1918 was very much a bacteriological world. There were bacteria all over the place, pre-antibiotic. So we know now that that must have made, you know, that was another factor that that comes into it.
How to explain the global reach of this pandemic? I understand it made it as far as the Arctic Circle.
There, the war, I think, has a lot to answer for. Well, all the troops, including American troops, in Europe by the autumn of 1918, British troops and colonial troops from all the colonies. And in November 1918, suddenly the whole thing finishes and they all want to go home. There was a huge movement of young men, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. There were some of them carrying the influenza. And the boat comes into South Africa. They go home up the railway lines. The railway lines were quite important in carrying this virus. It's a transport mechanism in 1918. They go to the furthest most spots in South Africa. Their parents that weekend call their friends in from a radius of about 10 miles. They come in by horse and cart to celebrate the young man coming home, and they all catch it. So it's a question of people movement, and there are a lot of people moving, probably more than had ever been moved before, probably 10, 15 million young people on the move, and that had a lot to do with it, I think.
Well, you mentioned the war as a crucial factor in transmitting this disease. Obviously, the war killed tens of millions of people. How do the casualties from World War I compare to the totals from the influenza pandemic?
Well, very much, they were very much smaller. I mean, it's bad enough, isn't it, to have, you know, 10 million, as you say, 12 million young men dying because of the war. But I feel myself now that whoever was responsible for that, and I must say I put it at the feet of politicians, it was their job to try and stop all this. That is their job. And they failed. So not only did that result in 10 million or more young people dying in that conflagration, but I think myself that if it had not been for that war, the pandemic would not have arisen. So I think now those responsible are responsible for 10 plus 50 million, that's 60 million. So it tells us in modern terms, you can start things off with these war things, but you never know where they're going to end.
And were there things that could be done to help?
The doctors and nurses tried and tried and tried. And in the group of doctors and nurses that I'm particularly involved in, looking back on, I read their papers in The Lancet, just as though they're talking to you now, right in the middle of those battles, when they were in 10 miles of the Western Front, day and night, all they got were explosives going off and shells and everything else. They were trying to look after these first patients coming in with what was the first kind of wave, the early wave of the Spanish flu. They even set up to try to help these soldiers. They even set up tents, and they had aromatics, you know, aromatic compounds and oils in those tents. So it was kind of a steam tent, and that I find so admiring. I mean, not only were they risking their lives, they were pretty close to the Western Front, all this going on, and they were making these tents of canvas and steam so they could persuade these ill soldiers to get up and sit in there and get some relief from it. So I think they were really into it, but all they could do in reality was that sort of thing, got the nursing care, a lot of care, and try and bring their temperatures down with aspirin. And there's not much else They could, if their heart began to fail, they had belladonnas and they had extracts. They could tackle that a little bit, but overall, again and again, you feel how helpless they felt at the time.
Well, whether it's that strain or not, what are your thoughts about the possibility for another global pandemic on the scale of the Spanish flu?
Well, I think all virologists, when we look at the past, you know, they've been pretty, not regular exactly, but they've been there coming out at us. And remember, the theory is that they're spread, these pandemic viruses come from the great migrating geese and ducks and swans of this world. And they've got all of the viruses, the mutating influenza viruses, all of them are in those migrators, not normally causing any problems. So they go on their business around the world on the migration routes, come into contact with domesticated ducks and creatures and turkeys, and then they're pressurized, the domesticated ones, because it's more like factory farming. And there you begin to get the symptoms if they catch it from a migrator and then push on the symptoms and the virus onto their keepers. So we know which way the virus comes now. We didn't know that before. So it's very difficult to say, well, that's not going to happen again, because it happened in, we know from recent history, in 1845, there was a big outbreak, it's almost certainly flu. 1889, the so-called Russian influenza was quite a big one. The 1918, 1957, 1968, 1976, and then 2009. So they're coming at us, and there's every reason, given the global population increasing and everything, everyone on the move, there's every reason to anticipate and plan for the next one.
That's going to do it for us today. Thanks for joining me in this dip back into the Backstory Archive. You can find the full episode of Forgotten Flu at our website, backstoryradio.org. And once you're there, don't forget to check out other episodes. There are hundreds to choose from. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.